We've been studying the Gospel of Luke, and one of the most popular stories in the Gospel of Luke is the story of the Good Samaritan. It's one of those stories that if you grew up in church, you can probably quote. In fact, you might be able to tell the story to your kids better than I can tell the story to you. So we're going to do it just a little bit differently this morning. But before we wrestle with that story, I want to share a quote from a book that I read about 6 months ago that has just kind of bothered me. In fact, it's bothered me not in the sense that I disagree with it. It's bothered me in the sense that I don't know if we practice it very well. So here's the quote. Unless and until we get back the mission of Christianity deep in our hearts, we are never going to be the people of God that He's called us to be. Let me read that again. Unless and until we get the basic mission of Christianity deep in our hearts, we are never going to be the people of God that He has called us to be. Now that's a tough statement. And I think one of the reasons that's a tough statement is we have done church from the inside out for the most of our lives. That church has been about this building. In fact, I'm in the foyer of our building that we're all in almost every Sunday. And we've kind of come to understand as church being what goes on in there. But the truth is church is far more than that. And the basic mission of Christianity is not to do church. It's not just for us to come in and worship on a Sunday morning, whether it's corporately or whether it's via the internet. It's not just to assemble within the walls of an auditorium to encourage each other and strengthen each other. It's meant to go out. And the mission of Christianity, which is supposed to be deep within us, is not one that is internalized within the church, but it's external as it goes out into the world. This is not just about taking the love of God across the seas. Now, I'm all for taking the love of God across the seas. The love of God needs to go to South America, and it needs to go to Asia, and it needs to go to Africa, and it needs to go to Europe, where Christianity is almost dead for that point. But it's more than just trying to get the message of the love of God across the seas, but I need to learn how to get it across the street. Now, to be honest, it is easier for me to get the message of the gospel across the seas. Because here's what I do. Got some friends, missionaries in Brazil. If they want to do something there, I will get an email from Josh Pruitt. And Josh Pruitt will say, we're doing this ministry, or we got this plan. And here's what I can do. I can reach in my back pocket. I can open up my wallet. And I can take out a wad of cash. Now, it's mostly ones. But I can take out a wad of cash, and I can give it to the office manager, and I can say, why don't you send this to Josh? Because they're doing something good in receiving. Now, I've just helped take the gospel across the sea. But what about when I need to take the gospel across the street? See, that may be the longest trip I ever take. Is the trip to Brazil is not near as difficult and not near as hard and not near as long as the trip across the street to my neighbor to say, here's what Jesus has to say. So we get to the story of the Good Samaritan, which is a story, oddly enough, that I think is about reaching out to the world around us. And our struggle with this story is not familiarity, but instead it's living it out. Like I said earlier, we can all quote the story. We can all tell the story of the man who's walking down the road and he sees the guy beat up, and before you know it, he takes him and he puts him on the donkey and away they go. But there's so much more to living out that story than just simply telling that story. So what I'd like to do this morning, and maybe this is just a little bit different, I want to read a little and preach a little, and then let's get to the end and let's talk about what I think Jesus is trying to say to a 21st century church. So the story begins like this. Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. He asked, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Now, there's the entrance to our story. And I don't know about you, but I find the entrance to this story rather impressive. Because I have a lot of friends who are lawyers. And they all ask great questions. What's interesting is all the lawyers that I know, at least all that are involved in the life of this church, and all that are involved in the community that I see, are good men and women. They're ethical, and they do the right thing. And they would never really be like the jokes that we hear talked about so often. But every one of them can ask really good questions. In fact, one of the members of our church works across the street from us at the Sanders Law Firm. And we can be sitting in the fellowship hall having a discussion about college football, and she knows college football. And we can be sitting there, and she'll be telling me about the importance of her team and why her team is better than my team, and she'll start to ask a few questions. And every one of those questions that she asks are always probing, and they are always great questions. And she's testing me. She's testing me to see if I really know what I'm talking about, if I really watch the University of Florida play football, or if I just watch SportsCenter. She's trying to gauge if I really know what I'm talking about. So here in the story, we get this lawyer that comes to Jesus, and he starts to ask some questions. And I think what the lawyer is trying to do is, I hope that he's seeking, I'm not 100% positive, but I hope that he is seeking some answers in his life. But he comes to Jesus and he says, I've got a good question. What do I need to do to get to heaven? And so this little verbal ping pong goes back and forth. Okay, now Jonah and I love to play ping pong. In fact, every now and then we set up the ping pong table in the living room and we move all the furniture to the walls, or we set it up in the garage and we move all the cars out, or we set it up outside and hope that the balls don't go down the street. And we go at it. And he hits the ball hard, and I'm good at blocking it. And he hits the ball hard at me, and I block it back. And we'll do that 5, 6, 7, 10 times back and forth. And finally he wins like he always does. But I wonder if the lawyer is playing a little bit of verbal and mental ping pong with Jesus. Jesus, what do I need to do to get to heaven? What do I need to do to have an eternal life? Is he testing Jesus? So Jesus responds in verse 26. Jesus says, what's written in the law? How do you read it? Okay, ball's back in his court. I mean, the guy has served it as fast as he can, and Jesus kind of pounds it back at him. And then the lawyer says, here's what the law says. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus will say, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. It's almost like Jesus is saying, okay, you've given me the right answer. You've given me the key point of the law of Moses, that here is God and here is everybody else, and you love them with everything you got. You've given me the right answer. Now just go and do it. I guarantee I could ask everybody in this church about the importance of the mission of Jesus to go out into a lost world with the gospel, and they would all say, that's important, and that's fundamental. And they could even quote the end of Matthew and the end of Mark and the beginning of Acts, and they could talk about feet that bear good news from Romans. They could all say the right things. But folks, it's got to be more than just saying, I got it. It's saying, I got it, and now I'm going to do it. So the lawyer in verse 29 asks Jesus, wanting to justify himself, the text says, and he says, and who is my neighbor? Ping pong back and forth. See, every Jew would define their neighbor most likely like this. My neighbor is another Jew just like me. Now, they wouldn't geographically do it like we do. I've got my neighbor on this side, and I've got my neighbor across the street, and I've got my neighbor behind the alley. Those are my neighbors. But the Jew would say, my neighbors are all the people that are like me, all those who are Jews like me. And are we any different? If I were to ask you, who is your neighbor, how would you respond? Now, would you respond like, this is my neighborhood and these are the people that I live next to? Or would you say, here are the people in the community that I'm surrounded by that God has called me to live and serve and hopefully teach? So in response to this question, who is my neighbor, Jesus tells this story that we all know so well. And so the story goes like this. Verse 30, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Okay, the stories of Jesus, I think, are pretty cool. Usually, the stories of Jesus have got at least a portion from the world that they live in. Here's a tree that produces fruit. Here's the prodigal son. Here's the lost coin. Here's the good Samaritan. They all have this bridge that brings the reality of everyday life within Judea into the beauty of his story. This road from Jerusalem to Jericho was a 17-mile road that was called in the days of Jesus the Bloody Way. Now, it was a road that had curves, and it was a road that kind of weaved in and out, and it was a road that had mountains that came right up to the edge of the road, and thieves loved this road because there were all kinds of places they could hide. And they could hide behind a big old rock, and when somebody came, they could jump out of the big old rock and say, "Wah!" and do whatever they needed to do. They would get this story. The minute Jesus tells a story about someone going from Jerusalem to Jericho, they would say, "Oh, that's the Bloody Way. That's that road." Just like if I tell a story to my church and say, "You're on your way to Albuquerque," they know that you got to go from Roswell to Vaughan. Now, Roswell to Vaughan, unless you are a rancher, is the most boring 90-mile stretch in all of God's beautiful created earth. It's a straight road with just about nothing to do. My people would know if I started a story, we're on our way to Roswell, that we'd be going to Vaughan. Same thing happens in this story. So now Jesus starts to enliven this story. He says in verse 31, a priest happened to be going down the same road. When he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. Okay, let me paraphrase this into 21st century church vernacular. Okay, here's the priest. He left church. He's on his way home. And the preacher checked his heart at the door. Okay, let's do a little internal search for a second. How often do you leave the church premise and you check your heart at the door? That you've just heard me, or you've just heard Michael, or you've just heard one of our elders, or a Bible class teacher, or you've walked out a small group, and the preacher, or the teacher, or the elder has said, "Here is what God has called us to do through His Word. Let's go out and do it." And you walk out the back door, or the front door, or the side door, and you check your heart at the door, and you never do a single thing that they told you you should do. That's exactly what the priest does here. He's been to church. He's done his job. I mean, if this is the world of Jesus, the priest has gone in there and he's done the stuff he's supposed to do in Jerusalem, and now he's on the road to Jericho and he sees the guy beaten in the ditch and he says, "I checked my heart at the door, I got other things to do," crosses the street and goes the other way and books it as quick as he can. It's kind of haunting. Okay, while I was reading that same book, he told the story of a Greek class in Princeton University. And Greek classes are weird. If you've never been to a Greek class, you've missed some good sleep time. But Greek classes, the more you get versed in Greek, the more you just take a Greek Bible and open it up and start translating. And so this Bible class that's got 70 students in it are all translating Luke chapter 10. And so they have been working on the text of the Good Samaritan for weeks. And so the professor decides he's going to test their knowledge and test to see if they've heard the text. And so he gets one of the actors from a different part of the school with plenty of makeup on to be laying on the sidewalk, beat up, bleeding from everywhere, in front of the building where they're going to go to attend class. And not one single of those 70 theological students stops to help the man beaten up on the side of the road. They could translate it. They could give you all the Greek words. They could say, "Here's what Jesus is trying to say." But when it came to living out the text, they totally missed the boat. Okay, let me say something really clear here for just a second. If our worship in here, okay, I'm pointing to the auditorium, and in a few weeks we're going to be back to worshiping in there. But if our worship in here doesn't call us to go out there, now I'm pointing outside of the parking lot, if our worship in here doesn't call us to go out there and make a difference, then I'm wasting my time. I've spent all week working on this sermon. I've spent all week praying over this text. I've spent days thinking, how can I tell my people to say, "Here's the story of the Samaritan. Let's go out and let's be good like him." And if all we do is walk in there, listen to a few words, put our Bible in the pew and walk out, I've done nothing good. because I've turned you into the priest. Or verse 32, I've turned you into the Levite. Because 32 is going to say, so too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. Pity's a weird word, and I think we miss a little bit of what Jesus is trying to say. For me, pity in a 21st century vernacular is, man, I feel sorry for that fellow. And that guy's broken down on the side of the road. I feel bad for him. Pity, in this sense, is the seat of emotion. If you've ever been somewhere where something happens, I'm going to embarrass myself, but this happens to me during Hallmark movies. You're watching the Hallmark movie and something bad happens to the main character and your stomach just kind of churns. And you feel deep within you this poor guy's tragedy. That's more than just, I feel sorry for him. That's a deep, heartfelt emotion. And Jesus says the Samaritan has far more than pity. The Samaritan has this deep set of emotion that from deep within him, his stomach churns, and the text says he goes and he bandages the wounds and he pours on oil and wine and he puts the man on his donkey and brings him to an inn and takes care of him. And the next day he pays to take care of him some more, and he says, if you need anything else, I will be there. Okay, in another part of the New Testament, Jesus, I think, calls this second mile Christianity. He doesn't put the Christianity part on there. I've done that for him. But he says, if someone asks you to go 1 mile carrying their stuff, you go too. Remember, that's from the end of the Sermon on the Mount there, or the end of chapter 5 of the Sermon on the Mount. That's exactly what the Samaritan does. The character who nobody thought would do this in the first place. I mean, most good Jews, including the lawyer that is in the audience of Jesus, would think Samaritan, they would think instantly, bad guy, bad character, no morals, no ethics. He wouldn't do a single thing. And yet he's the one who's got far more than pity and who goes the second mile. And then Jesus asked this question, which of the three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hand of robbers? And the expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. And Jesus told him, go and do likewise. Okay, so if Jonah and I are playing ping pong, this final little thing is the one where Jonah rears back with that 6-foot arm span and hits that ping pong ball as fast as he can right at my head and wins. Jesus says, here's the neighbor. So what do you do with this story? I think there are some important principles that need to come out of this story that need to dominate my life, not because I'm the preacher, but because I'm God's and because I'm saved by the blood of the very one who tells this story. The first thing is we need to learn to lead a different kind of life. Okay, I'm not a big fan of 3D movies. You know, when you wear glasses and you have an astigmatism and then you put on another pair of glasses on it and you're already colorblind and it fixes, it just gives me a big old headache. But I need to lead a 3D life. Now, I wished I was smart enough to come up with these things, but someone else did, and I'm going to borrow their stuff. The first thing of living a 3D life is we decide to engage. See, this is done way ahead of time. Every morning, even in the midst of lockdown, every morning I pray this prayer, God, put people in my path so I can minister to them. Help me to be the eyes and the ears and the hands and the feet of Jesus. As I go about in this community that I love so much, I've got to decide to engage. And we do that every morning, and we do it because it's the right thing. But then the second part of being 3D thinking is we got to discover their story. See, there have been moments when I've been visiting with the lost that I tend to get maybe a little judgy. And in the back of my head, I'm saying, well, they had that coming. Well, they kind of deserve, you reap what you sow, and this, and this, and this. And instead, I need to hear their story. Let me give you an example of one from a few years back that has forever changed the way I minister to people. Person came to me, they were a friend of a friend of a friend who went to this church, and so they come to me and they say they want to talk, and so we meet at Starbucks, which is my favorite place to just go sit and talk. And so I buy the guy a cup of coffee and I take one look at him and I know that he's had a rough life. I can tell that he has abused alcohol and drugs. I could tell that there have been moments in his life when he could have cared less about if he lived or died. I could tell that he had gone through things I couldn't even fathom. And there was a moment when I started to prejudge him, which is so totally wrong on my part and really all of our parts. But then he started to tell his story. And he started to tell the story of his parents and how his parents had gone through tragedy of losing his older brother. And in the midst of them losing his older brother, they lost each other and they divorced. And one spiraled into addiction and the other spiraled into being a workaholic. And here he lived out in this home being pulled back and forth between one parent who worked all the time and the other parent who drank all the time. And then he tried to get away from that and went to a state school. And before you knew it, he got in the wrong crowd at the state school, and in the midst of that, he was drinking and he was smoking marijuana, and then he was doing cocaine. And before you know it, he's out of money, so he's doing meth. And the more I heard him tell his story, the more my perspective changed. See, when I went into the coffee shop, it was, and this guy's had a hard life, and he's paying for it now. When I came out of the coffee shop was, man, this guy's had a hard life, and how else could he cope? How else could he cope with the disaster that the previous 20 years had brought his life? No wonder he's in a mess. And now God maybe has inserted me here in this place to reach out and say, here's an answer. But I had to hear his story first, because learning somebody else's story is always a powerful experience. And in learning his story, I found out how I could help. I found out ways I could minister and ways I could encourage and avenues I could teach. And it led to a beautiful friendship, and it led to somebody eventually becoming a child of God. We've got to discover their story. But then we've got to discern the next steps. Okay, he didn't just bandage the wounds and send him off. He bandaged the wounds and said, what do I need to do next? Okay, if I'm the Good Samaritan in the midst of the story, and I know this isn't the point of Jesus, but let's, for the fun of it, kind of follow along. Okay, I've got his wounds bandaged, and I've got him on the back of my horse. I can take him into town and leave him there and hope he figures it out. Or I could get him to the inn, throw out some of my hard-earned money to the one who's going to take care of him, to meet his needs, and when he's better, then we can go from there. One of the things we've got to do in the midst of the world that we serve is we've got to say, what do they need next?